It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm your host, Shelley Brisbane. Welcome back to a discussion of classic film. This is episode 71, Gun Crazy. This is a noir classic from 1950, and I have two wonderful panelists who you may know to talk about it with me. First up, it's Ready to Tingo. Welcome back.
You know, you sent an email to us this morning, and the subject line was Gun Crazy Tonight. Is that why there are 12 FBI agents at my door?
I thought you were going to give me a hard time because I sent the wrong URL. Okay, fine. Yeah, sorry about the FBI agents. They're just friends of mine. You can
I'll tell them to get lost. That won't be a problem.
Bring them in for some cookies or something. I don't know. Also joining us is Nathan Alderman. Hi.
Hi. So, this movie is called Gun Crazy, or as they refer to it in Texas, Tuesday.
You bet, buckaroos.
And I should say I am from Texas. I was born there. I can say that.
Well, I can agree because I live here now and I'm trying to stay in the closet where hopefully the guns can't reach me. But you never know because people have high-powered rifles. Anyways, it's Gun Crazy, a movie from 1950 directed by Joseph H. Lewis, starring John Dahl and Peggy Cummins. None of those names may mean anything to you, even if you've been a past listener to this show, because even though Joseph H. Lewis, as we will discuss, gets an incredible amount of credit for this film, as he should, Dahl and Cummins are not very well known. And I don't know, I almost think Barry Kroger might be, or Russ Tamblyn is probably the most well-known person in this movie, which does not diminish it in any way. The reason we're talking about it is because it is definitely a noir classic. It has a lot to do with the style of directing, with cinematography, with the script. And we'll get into all of that. But I want to ask each of you, starting with Randy, what your experience with this movie was before. You're a noir guy. You've probably seen this before.
I've seen it before, but I got to tell you. You know, this is the same old story. Boy meets girl. Girl is a sociopath. Boy becomes literally pistol whipped. And their bullet-ridden bodies end up in a California swamp. I mean, we've seen it a zillion times before.
I mean, totally. Also, how did that swamp get up in the mountains? Weren't they in the mountains before? Now they're in a swamp?
They were there a long time. There was kind of climate change.
Yes, there's a lot of geographical changing going on.
It's one of those Nathan, mountain swamps.
Yeah. Nathan, have you seen Gun Crazy before?
I had seen it many years ago. Again, this is one of those Netflix was my film school titles. And I, like most of them, I had forgotten large chunks of it. I remembered the opening and I'd forgotten just how really good this movie is. Holy smokes. This is a really good movie, and it's all the more amazing because the director, you look at his IMDb credits, and this is it, basically, aside from a bunch of television and a bunch of movies that no one's ever heard of.
Right. He made a bunch of Westerns, and he went into television directing in the late 50s. He had been he had sort of worked his way up through the ranks in the directing side of the biz since the late 20s. And it's funny because this movie is so well-regarded, and Joseph H. Lewis is well-regarded because of it, but then the evidence of his other career is pretty much, he did something interesting like the single shot bank robbery scene in one movie previously, and he hired a good cinematographer. And so none of these people, this movie is very unprepossessing when you just sort of look at the credits for it. Just like, wait, what? Who? Okay, it's a B picture. It's done by the King brothers who, you know, burst on the scene in '45 with Dillinger, which was a crazy noir that we could talk about at some point. But, you know, all these low budget movies, this movie had higher distribution because it was a United Artists release. It had a super low budget. They did have 30 days to film it, but it was budgeted at something like $400,000. And it didn't do as well financially as they would have liked, but it wasn't a bomb. And they had some expectations for it, you know, on the modest budget that it had. So we go into this movie kind of, I mean, I went into this movie, I've seen it several times before, but each time I watch it, I'm always like, I'm surprised at how good it is too, because it just doesn't strike you when you start watching the movie that it's going to be a great film. And the ways it's great are, I don't know, subtle is the wrong word, but from my perspective, they're surprising. They're just like, oh, wow, that was kind of amazing, wasn't it?
Everything's from the beginning. I mean, the beginning is pretty slow. My friend was here to watch it with me, and he fell asleep because not a whole lot happens in the first few scenes. But once it gets up to speed, it's just a wild ride. That's, you know, I've seen it before, but I could feel my heartbeat, you know, like going up, and just the music and the cinematography and the performances, just everything clicked. And you know they spent like, you know, $3 on this, and everything just worked out so perfectly.
Yeah. So Lewis, like I said, the director, Joseph H. Lewis, doesn't have a lot of credits to his name, but he hired, as Shelley mentioned, really well. You got the cinematography by Russell Harland, who went on to do To Kill a Mockingbird, The Thing from Another World, Witness for the Prosecution, also Pollyanna, for some reason. But, you know, so an incredible cinematographer. And you look at the shots in this movie, and they're really cleverly set up so that they're stylish and they tell the story, but they also save money. You know, he doesn't bother cutting away. He just has John Dahl's character shrink into a corner of the frame as he recedes away from the friends who are trying to pull him out of this life of crime. And it's great because you can just set up the camera and leave it there for the whole shot and not have to worry about a camera move or anything. But it also tells the story. The amazing single take bank robbery sequence from the backseat of a car. You don't have to build a bank set. You don't have to, you know, get a bunch of extras. You can just get a camera in the back of the car, start it rolling, and do the whole thing in one take. And, you know, if you have to set it up again, it's really easy to go back and set it up again.
They had actually planned to do that with a bank set. And Lewis said, I've got a way to do it without it. And I want to save that for a little bit later, because it comes a little later in the film and I've got a couple stories to tell about it. But there are some things that he did clearly to save money, and there's some things that he did because that's kind of the way he wanted to do it. And it's interesting because, yeah, you're right, Harland's cinematography career is more sort of notable. I've read a number of things today that give Lewis credit for sort of the vision of the film and some of the design of it. Things like the bank scene, things like just sort of the way that John Dahl is sort of like half in a frame when he probably should be in the whole frame. And one of my favorites none of the things I read today talked about, but I thought was fascinating, where like he shoots through a steering wheel up into the face of the people in the car. It's just like, oh my, that's a great. Anyways, so we start out with our protagonist. I actually think the very first scene of the movie, even though we get slow a little after that, I think the very first scene of the movie is pretty arresting, where you see a boy going through a window of a hardware store so that he isn't personally going through the window. He's breaking the window so that he can steal a gun. And he is a little kid. And the next thing you know, he's hauled into court. And there's this really long court scene where they talk about his love of guns. Oh, but it's okay because he would never kill anybody. He would just shoot at things. And we have the testimony of his sister and his friends and all of the people who know him. And that scene is actually, it's kind of interestingly done because he's always like in the corner of that scene, just sitting there not saying or doing anything. But it does sort of change the pace of the movie for a little while until you get to, you know, later scenes when you see him. There's a flashback in there, and then you get to later scenes where he's, you know, a teenager and then an adult. But I did sort of think that courtroom scene was kind of long. And I also thought that that judge took an immense amount of care. I don't know that I've ever seen the criminal justice system quite that indulgent, even though they sent him to reform school, quite that indulgent of somebody who is basically in trouble for doing something bad.
Well, it's the 1950s and he's white, so, you know.
That's fair point, yeah.
But I actually like that scene. I like the first scene, too, because the opening credits roll and then the camera pulls back. And what you think is just a shot of a street, you're actually seeing through the window of the hardware store that he's going to break into, which I thought was really cleverly done. But I like that court scene because, you know, it's the first time when you see the little human touches that Lewis puts into his actors' performances. When the sweet old lady comes up to deliver her testimony, she gets really excited and flustered and has to slow down because she's talking too fast. And that's not crucial to the story, but it establishes her character very quickly and effectively, and it makes you feel like this isn't, like it's more realistic and believable.
Yeah, and the kid is very much not the star of the scene, but as I say, he's present, and it's clear that all the conversation is about him, and we're learning about this kid as a person who's only, you know, and just as in plenty of movies, there's a thing that the lead character cares desperately about. In this case, it's guns, but they are constrained to point out that he would never kill anything or anybody because he accidentally killed his pet as a child, and it horrified him, and so he'll never kill. But he loves guns so much that he went into this hardware store and took one. And then they sent him off to reform school for 4 years and then into the army. What I think is interesting about those choices is it's not like the traditional plotting of a movie like that where he's gone to reform school and he becomes hardened. He doesn't seem like he's changed all that much when he comes out as John Dahl, the very tall, lanky adult. He's just a guy who is still obsessed with guns and who got so bored with, using guns in an interesting way in the army that he is kind of looking around for something to do. But I'm really not sure why the reform school choice was made other than, I guess, to give him, I mean, it's a good backstory, I guess, but it wasn't one of those things where he comes out, I'm hardened, I'm a different person than I was before I went in.
And not even the war did it. I mean, reform school and a war, neither seemed to turn him into anything beyond kind of this dopey happy kind of guy that he seems to be at first.
I think they needed those early scenes just to establish the depth of his compulsion, but also the really interesting push-pull with his character. He is obsessed with guns. He loves firing guns, but he desperately does not want to hurt anyone. You read sometimes about psychopaths, a very rare, but that they exist, who realize that they are psychopaths, realize that they have the capacity to hurt people and seek help because they don't want to. And that is a really compelling facet of John Dahl's character here. I also like that, you know, in Bad Day at Black Rock, we talked about how Lee Marvin looked like evil Ted Lasso. And all while I'm watching this movie, I thought that John Dahl looked like nice Lee Marvin.
For some reason, as I was watching the movie today, I had some substitute casting in mind, which I think I'll save for a little bit, but it might surprise you. It wasn't Lee Marvin, believe it or not. So we've met John Dahl's character as a child and then as a teen and then as an adult. And we've also met these two friends of his that he goes shooting with. There's an early scene, which I think is a flashback during the courtroom scene, where they're out shooting, and they have the opportunity to shoot a mountain lion, and they tell the character Bart, John Dahl's character, well, it's not John Dahl at this point, it's Russ Tamlin at this point, to shoot the mountain lion, and John Dahl can't even do that, even though there's a bounty on the mountain lion. So I want to point out that this movie has already been hard on animals. We've lost his little pet chipmunk early in the movie, and the mountain lion, he couldn't kill the mountain lion, but the other guy shot at the mountain lion, so this is not the cat does well. In this movie, they miss him, but
I mean, the mountain lion was running a money laundering scheme, so you know he had it coming. It would have been a clean kill.
Yes, we can diverge from plot at any point you gentlemen want to. I'm just sort of doing enough setup to sort of get us into the present day, because most of this is set from now on, where John Dahl is an adult. He's come back, or Bart is the name of his character. He's come back from the war, from the army, or rather, it's not indicated whether he's actually in the war. He was teaching marksmanship at some point, which bored him, I guess, probably because they weren't as good a shot as he was. And he doesn't have a job, any prospects, and he and his buddies go to the carnival, and then he meets Annie Laurie, Peggy Cummins. He meets her rising into the scene with her blazing pistols, and it's love at first sight.
Well, you know, she's a little bit country, a little bit, I killed a man in Reno just to watch it.
That's a little too long to put on the title card, but you know, yeah.
That's right. She did kill a man in Reno.
It was St. Louis.
I think it was St. Louis. Yeah, she did. Later, she kills a man in Reno. Oh, Peggy Cummins. She's an English actress, very interesting actress. She also had a career as John Dahl did in the movies in the 40s. He was probably most famously one of the leads in Rope. Mm-hmm. He was nominated for Best Supporting Actor. Peggy Cummins, had been in various small parts. She was considered or was hired for the lead in Forever Amber, but then they replaced her with Linda Darnell because they didn't think she could carry it, I guess. And so, you know, here she is. But this is kind of the pinnacle of their acting careers, really, especially on film. Like, he does some stage work. She retires from acting in the early 60s. She actually had quite long a life and lived long enough to spend a lot of time on the film circuit talking about this movie, because this movie was kind of rediscovered in the noir renaissance. And Peggy Cummins and would hang out with Eddie Muller and talk about this film, and apparently liked to do so. John Dahl died fairly young, and as I say, he had some work in stage and television and film. It's just so funny to see. I mean, I've seen plenty of movies that have non-stars in them, but it's just funny to see a movie like this that you know is a really good movie, and you just don't recognize anybody in it.
No, but they're good.
Yes,
they're
they are
really good. And I think some of that owes to the direction and some to the performance and some to the script, which is written by McKinley Cantor, who wrote The Best Years of Our Lives, Millard Kaufman, who wrote or co-wrote Bad Day at Black Rock, and Dalton Trumbo. I mean, that is a murderer's row of writing talent.
Yeah, it was based on a Saturday Evening Post story by Cantor, and then Millard Kaufman essentially took the credit. Unlike people whose names are on films that they didn't write, he was actually, as you say, a distinguished film writer, film screenwriter. He wrote Bad Day at Black Rock and a number of other films. But Trumbo actually wrote it, and what's interesting about it is this was like right when he was blacklisted. Trumbo was a writer who was a member of the Hollywood 10, and he has literally just been blacklisted. And so it's not like, oh, we're going to wait a year and then we're going to hire you. He was actually trying to make enough money to keep himself out of jail and to deal with some debts that he had. And they hired him on the QT. The producers did, the King brothers did. And Lewis either didn't know or for years did not admit to knowing, because obviously there were several years where you wouldn't have admitted that, and it was, you know, fireable if you were hiring blacklisted writers. But even later in life, Lewis said he didn't know that that was the case, and so there's some confusion as to whether he knew in the first place or whether he simply found out later. And but Dalton Trumbo is widely believed to have been the only screenwriter based on the Cantor story.
I like this movie because it would be so easy, especially in the moralistic 50s, to have this be the story of two kill crazy psychos just like shooting up the place. And obviously there is a perverse element to their love for each other, but it's also love. They really do care about each other. Annie Laurie Starr she's messed up, but she's a person. She's not just a cardboard cutout femme fatale. She really cares about Bart, and Bart really loves her. And that empathy that you have for them, even as you know both these people are just doomed, it makes the film unusually heartbreaking. It's not just like the movie's not throwing them to the wolves for your entertainment. It wants you to see them as people. And I really, really appreciate that about this movie. Yeah.
They're really hot for each other as well. So you can't leave that part out. And I think her reaction to him is probably more, what can I get out of this guy at first? And then she gradually falls in love with him. She's hot for him as well. But that's what's interesting about it, because if there's a love at first sight element, it's from him. And she's more ambivalent, and she's got stuff going on in her life. And she tells him early on, I'm bad. It doesn't mean that she's going to stop hanging out with him. But there's a point later in the movie where we see proof that she's like, fine, I want to be with you. I'm kind of stuck with, this is my lot in life. And it is interesting because it is heartbreaking, even though they've both done, especially her, but they've both done things they shouldn't have done and things that are criminal things. And it reminds me, although it's compared to Bonnie and Clyde, because they of how it ends, and also just because of the sort of desperate nature of their attempts to escape later on, and they're being chased by the cops. The movie it reminds me of is They Live by Night, which is Farley Granger and Kathy O'Donnell. And I've got that scheduled on the list later on, but it's a sort of a tragic noir love story of these characters, neither of whom is particularly effectual at getting out of this situation they're in, and they're destined to end tragically. But they're so profoundly likable, and heartbreaking is probably a better word than likable, because they are likable characters, but they just, like, you just want them to catch a break. And there are moments in this movie where you feel that about these people, even once they basically say, we're going to become, you know, robbers for the rest of the movie.
I feel like you can see in a couple scenes, you can really see this, their sexual attraction. The scene where Bart is watching Annie up on stage, and he has what can only be described as a shit-eating grin. I mean, it's just remarkable. He's just smiling from ear to ear. And then for Annie, the scene where she's telling Bart to either do crime or get lost, and she lies back in the bed, and you can see like a shadow of Bart leaning over her, and she starts, you can see this like she's panting just real briefly, and I thought that was just extraordinary for a movie of this time.
Well, and also the way they shot that, because yeah, you see her face, then you see his shadow, and then he comes into frame, and it's a very lustful scene, because she's basically said to him, yeah, you know go away or stick with me and we're going to do this, and he clearly says, I'm a slave to my body or to my love for you or whatever it is. And it's shown physically on screen in a way that kiss is pretty explicit, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Although really, I kind of blame the guy's two friends. You hear the tragic story of Chris Kyle, the soldier whose life was chronicled in the movie American Sniper, and how he would try to work with other veterans who were troubled by their experiences in wartime. But the guy who ended up killing him, it happened when Chris Kyle said, hey, fellow sniper who's troubled by your war experiences, let's go to a shooting range together, which in hindsight was maybe not the wisest decision. And here you've got John Dahl's buddies who are like, hey, you're just out of the army. You really love to shoot things to an unhealthy degree, which we both know because we were testifying at your court case when you were a kid. Let's go take you to the carnival. And oh, there's a lady here who shoots really well. Let's go take you to that. No, guys, no. You go, hey, look over here. There's a seal. Let's see what the seal is doing.
To be fair, I suspect John Dahl, especially because they had gone shooting that afternoon in the mountains or wherever it was. And my guess is John Dahl probably would have talked him into it. And I can see them being at the carnival and him seeing that shooting exhibit and him going, I'm going to go over there. And they're, all right, fine, John Dahl, we'll come with you. Jeez.
But instead they're like, no, John Dahl, go up on stage. Here is our money. Take it.
That's true. That's a good point. They raise money so that he can bet with Annie Laurie that he's a better shot than she is. And that's interesting. So the first thing that attracts him to her is that he sees what a good shot she is. And it's like, oh, she's also hot. She's also somebody I, yeah, yeah.
And they're trying to set him up with her. They're like, right? Look, she likes guns to an unhealthy degree, too. They're perfect for each other.
What could possibly go wrong?
Couldn't they have set her up with the bearded lady? I mean, come on.
Something. I don't know. Well, and she...
One of them is a law enforcement officer. Dude, you exercise better judgment. The other is a newspaper reporter. These guys both should have seen this coming from like 15 miles off. This is all they do all day.
But then we wouldn't have had a movie at all now, would we?
That's true.
So in fairly short order, Bart and Annie Laurie are on the run together because she has been hooked up with the guy, the carny, the guy who runs the carnival. And we find out a little more about that later. At the beginning, we find out that he's possessive of her and she's like not into him anymore. And she's into John Dahl. And then there's an incident with a gun where the carny is basically being physically aggressive with her. And John Dahl's way of dealing with it is to shoot a gun within an inch of his face. And the carny's like, oh, okay, sure. And he said, and then he says, you're fired. I don't know if I'd say that to a man with a gun who just shot at me, but whatever. And so they begin their life on the run. And what we find out fairly quickly is that Annie Laurie is going to want some money because she is not happy living on the run as the girlfriend / wife of a carny. And so she is going to she wants him to begin sticking up stores and eventually banks. And what I was going to say about what we find out about the carny much later in the film, because there is this allusion to the fact that, oh, she killed somebody in St. Louis. And what we find out much later in the film is that actually happened during a robbery that she did with this guy that she had been with before. So this is not her first rodeo as far as saying, you know what would be fun is if we did crime together. The scenes where we get interesting cinematography begin once we're sort of on the run with them. And there's sort of a montage at the beginning where we're seeing them do fairly small robberies, liquor stores and gas stations and things like that. And then the big job that they're going to do is this bank heist. And the scene that everybody talks about in this movie is this one long shot, which is taken from the back of the car. So behind is done in a real car. It was done behind John Dahl and Peggy Cummins, who are in the front seat. She's driving and he's going to get out and go and enter the bank. And the original plan was for them to do a standard sort of bank robbery scene. And Joseph Lewis said, hey, what's the point of being in the bank? What's the point of making that set and hiring all those extras and stuff? Instead, let's get in the car. Let's drive down a street. Let's have them look for a parking place. And oh, by the way, let's do it in a real town with extras that are people in the town, which is how they did it. And it was his idea to do the scene this way. And the way he tested out whether it would work was to take his own 16 millimeter camera and sit in the back of a car and basically do a test run. And once it worked, then they put their camera in a real car on a bench. They greased the bench up so that they could slide the camera left and right as they needed to in order to make it, quiet. And they had the actors, they gave the actors what the scene was, but the dialogue is improvised. There are microphones all over the car. It sounds very naturalistic. She's like giving him, or he's giving her parking guidance and, pull up here, turn right. And so it's just like this, it's really a surprising and arresting scene, but not because it's full of pyrotechnics, but because it's just so cleverly and arrestingly shot.
And it's really tense.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't know what's going on inside that bank. And then the cop walks up and Annie has to get out of the car. And there's that, as if Annie and Bart's relationship weren't sexualized enough. Then you have the cop grabbing Annie's gun to inspect it. But when she tries to do the same, he's like, no, nobody touches my gun. And then is the cop going to shoot them? What's going to happen? And then, John Dahl runs out of the bank, clocks the cop over the back of the head. Then the scene doesn't cut. They get back in the car and they drive away and they're, you're still with them. It feels like you're right there. It's a great way of making you feel like an accomplice to this crime and thus tying you to them so much more emotionally.
And this is fairly soon after they have taken the car. They come up with a gimmick of her getting the car by basically hitchhiking and then taking a car from a driver. And all that is sort of rolled into the bank heist. They're still in that car when they go and rob that bank. And there are a lot of scenes in this movie where they're not necessarily being chased. They're in cars and they're making movements. Sometimes they're switching cars. Sometimes they're, driving fast. But it's not a tradition. In most cases, and there is a chase a little later, but in most cases, it's not really a chase. But there's a lot of stuff happening in cars between them. There's a lot of stuff happening in cars with them getting in and out of cars. There's a lot of stuff happening where they switch cars. And it's super interesting. And it never sort of devolves into, okay, well, we're going to have a bunch of cop cars chase this one car, and then they're going to be scared, and then it's going to be over.
And it's so naturalistic that somebody online noticed that when they're in the convertible and they're running away from the on the run from the bank, Annie's hair is completely blown out when you see it from the back, and which is what happens in a convertible. Whenever you're typically in a convertible in the movies, the woman's hair looks fantastic because they're filming it in a studio. But this was filmed. Apparently there was one rear projection scene, maybe the one in the cab at the end, and everything else was filmed on the road in a car. And so things just looked really realistic, and it gives it that extra bump in tension because you're everything looks so real.
And when the police are chasing them, they don't need to have like a ton of cop cars and dynamic camera moves and escalating explosions and things, because they've already set up that the conflict here is between Bart's lust to kill and his desire not to kill. And so you get real tension. You know that Bart can make any shot he wants. The question is, which shot is he going to make? Is he going to shoot the driver or is he going to shoot the tire? And that creates real suspense and real sympathy for him, because you see him like struggling with and horrified by his impulse to kill. And you don't see that in movies like this.
Right.
In these movies, bad people are bad people. And here they're just people who are making bad choices.
And some of the tension in that scene is from the fact that the way they have him positioned. So Annie Lurie is driving. He's in the right front seat, but he's leaned over. He's hunched and he's got a gun. He's aimed at the cop car behind him, and he's either going to shoot the cop or the tires. But they show him from the back again so that he's hunched over and he's like in this physically compressed state. And most of the scene is his face and the gun. And so all the tension is in his body and in his face. She's trying to drive. She's trying to tell him to shoot at the same time. And it cuts back and forth between him and the cop car that's pursuing them. And it's so good.
And I think this is really, it's a landmark for gender equality, because it really shows that the woman can be more psychopathic than the man.
They do have a pretty egalitarian relationship, though. You know, they make decisions together. There's power dynamic between them shifts, but it's pretty balanced overall. They're very much partners in crime, which, again, is pretty interesting.
Right. It's her idea. She starts the life of crime thing. But once he's agreed to it, he's fully on board and he's actually participating in planning and making decisions, because there's a scene, which is another interesting shot, where it's overhead and they're looking at a map of this meat processing plant that they're going to rob later. And you see him direct. He's sort of coaching her in the rehearsal of what they're going to do. And then she repeats it back to him and he says, OK, again. And that goes back and forth throughout the movie. And there's some times when she's sort of leaning on him, like even though she's perfectly capable, as we will see later, of shooting a gun herself and will, she's leaning on him for some planning and for some quote unquote muscle, even though he's not, you know, he's not running around fighting people. He's shooting guns, which is, again, she's entirely capable of doing so. They seem to, it varies who drives. There's not like it's her car to start with. And then very quickly when they get on the run and they start switching back and forth, it's not really apparent or important who's driving, except that the other person is usually doing something like maybe shooting out the tires of the cop car. And so, yeah, it does seem to go back and forth. And again, by the time after the bank heist, I can't remember exactly when I sort of felt it. Obviously, there's the scene where they think they're going to part and then they decide not to part and stay together. But even before that, there's a point in the movie that, again, it's, I don't think it's a single moment. I think it's over time that you realize they are in love with each other or in lust with each other or some combination. It's not just that she's leading him down the primrose path by an appendage. He's fully participating. He's reluctant and he's regretful, and he doesn't know that she's willing and able to kill as she is, but he's not the complete dupe.
So, Nathan, why do you think he's a psychopath? I'm sure she is. But for him, I feel like that scene where he kills the chick as a boy and feels bad, I feel like that shows that he has some sort of inner sense of empathy. That
he does.
I don't know if I'd see her like being sad over a chick.
I feel like she knows there's something wrong with her, and she wants to be better than she is, and she makes that clear. And it's not just a line. The movie shows you that there are certainly times when she regrets what she's done. I think he's a psychopath, or however you want to. I mean, maybe not the clinical definition, but he's still obsessed with guns. Even that experience doesn't pry away, you know, his obsession with having guns, with using guns, with the power of guns, with the Freudian symbolism of guns. It just gives him like this counterweight obsession of, I can't kill, killing feels horrible, but I love guns, but I can't kill, but I love guns, but I can't kill. And that, I think, is a really interesting aspect of his character. I also wanted to talk briefly about his sister, Ruby, and the way the movie. So in 1950s movies, most of the time when you see a housewife, she's beautiful and perfectly put together, and like she's smiling and she has a beautiful home and her children are happy and well behaved. And while Ruby, his sister, has clearly a loving household, after the first time you see her, you know, when, oh, Judge, I'm going to get married and I've met a nice man and he'll be able to take care of Bart and I. Years later, she's exhausted. Her children are screaming and misbehaving and she's snapping at them, understandably. She's a wreck. Her house is a mess. And when she picks up the phone, she's like, what? And I have been that parent. I think if anyone who's been a parent has been that parent. But I loved that it was yet another way of that this movie acknowledged, yeah, things weren't great if you were a housewife in the 1950s, especially if your husband was mysteriously absent.
Right, because there's the point early on in the movie where she, when he's still going through the trial, where she says, yeah, I'm about to get married, and they even name the husband, and they say, and he said that Bart can come and live with us, but we never see him. I mean, then eventually she has like three kids by him, so clearly the marriage has lasted for some time.
Well, two kids and a hostage.
Oh, right. I forgot. Little baby hostage.
What the rule is, leave the cannoli, take the baby.
Trust me, As a parent, that is horrifying. Oh, my God. When she's like, we can take the baby. He'll be a hostage. You're like, no, no, God, no. And then they like, it's a good thing that the movie immediately reassures you that his friends, the police officer and the reporter are right there because like they put the kid down in like a wagon or something outside and he is crying and screaming for his mom who is locked up in a shed.
Who's locked up in the garage.
Oh, God. And that's just another example of how this movie does not play around. This movie is willing to go there.
So about the motivations, both of them say at different times during the movie, and I think it's interesting that they choose to use the same words. Each of them says that they kill when they're scared. And he does, like, he is more terrified and more thoughtful about, you know, whether he's going to kill. The one point at which I actually thought he might kill is early on when he shoots toward the carny who is being aggressive toward his wife or who is his future wife. And I thought the explanation was going to be, well, you hurt my girl. But that didn't end up happening. But she later on says, you know, I kill when I'm scared. And I think that probably that would, under scrutiny, it's probably more complicated than that. I think her impulse to kill probably is closer to the surface than just I'm terrified for my life. Because I think that she has an angry, mean streak, and that she uses her gun. You know, some of the way she speaks in the movie, even to him, but mostly to other characters who are in her way. She's clearly angered by them. And so fear makes her kill. I think her explanation to him is, I kill when I'm scared, which is, I think, an explanation that he can understand, even if he doesn't agree with it, even if it, you know, tweaks his moral compass a lot. But I think for her, she kills from anger. She kills from fright. She kills from anger, too, in a way that he never would. She would kill more quickly than he would. He's going to anguish over it before he does anything.
Yeah, she's not scared of that lady at the meatpacking plant that she killed.
No, she's angry.
She's annoyed with her.
How dare you punch the burglar alarm? I'm going to kill you now.
That whole sequence is, again, fantastic. It's funny, especially with his, you know, Bart's offhanded comments to his coworkers. Oh, you'll never get rich in this racket. Oh, I don't know about that. But
it's so interesting that they chose to do it. This meatpacking plant that has so many sets. Not even sets, because it's a location shoot. But there's the trucks, there's where the meat is hanging, the lockers, there's the office where they've both gotten jobs there in order to set up their payroll robbery, which is what they're going to do. But there's all of this detail, there's all these set pieces. There's the outer office where she works, there's the inner office where they end up, where they're going to get the payroll money. They use that set of stairs a couple of times when they're coming up and when they're making their getaway. And it's a great, like, rich set. And when it was funny because it says Armor Meat. You know, Armor is a natural meat company. But for some reason, I saw Armor and I was thinking Armored Car.
That's
for some
I
reason.
Thought
I
was thinking, too,
well, wouldn't it have been simpler if you just, you know, went and, like, robbed a financial institution, but meat processing plant? For some reason, I guess that was their target of opportunity.
And how did they get Armor meat packers to allow these shoots? What did they get out of this? You know, the you get to see.
Yeah, it does seem like you'd want that associated with your business.
I think they chose a meatpacking plant because you get a lot of production value. Mm-hmm. You get, you know, this all these great spaces and visuals that you can use. And you get that image of mechanized death, of row after row after row of carcasses hanging. It's a way to kind of create this atmosphere of doom, but quietly and subtly. And I love how they run through that meatpacking plant through the long corridors, and the camera just sits and watches them as they scramble and trip and get back up again. It so much adds to the tension more than fast cuts would, because you're holding your breath the whole time. Are they going to trip? Are they going to fall? Is someone going to come out of a doorway at any moment and shoot at them? Again, another fantastic sequence in this movie filled with them.
Yeah, I love the variety of spaces in that whole sequence. And you're right. And just this movie in general, when people talk about great cinematography, they tend to speak about flourishes or about designs of light and shadow and that sort of thing, especially in noir. And this there isn't a lot of darkness in this movie. There are a couple of night scenes that are not particularly significant to the plot. But this is not about quick cutting. The stylized nature of the photography, when it exists, is about the shots themselves, and it's about the angles. Like I was saying before, the steering wheel thing that I found fascinating, the overhead shot, obviously the bank scene, and the scenes where a character is sort of in a weird place relative to the rest of the frame in a different way than you would expect them to be. And so in that way, I'm one of the reasons I am less a fan of modern movies than a lot of people are is that I'm not a fan of jump cutting and pyrotechnics and that sort of thing. That's just not a style of movie I particularly enjoy, which isn't to say that you can't do it extremely well. But what makes this movie such a sleeper for me is that you watch it, and if you're just you've been told that it is a tour de force of cinematography and direction, and it's a tight script and all of that stuff, but it is not a showy movie at all. It does what it does, and it does it really beautifully.
So I have a question for you, Shelley. Is it typical that girls learn from their mothers to not wear a dress when performing an armed robbery? Is that typical?
You know, that is not advice my mom gave me, but I was a pants-wearing kid. I think my mom would have preferred me to wear dresses, probably so that I could avoid a life of crime.
I figured it was like something you would learn, like how to get out of a car elegantly.
Exactly. Oh, well. Exactly. Yeah, she wears dresses in plenty of other scenes where she's doing, but she has to run in this scene, so, you know, upstairs and downstairs, and so perhaps it's a little easier.
No, Randy, I wanted to ask your opinion as the noir expert here. This is the second recent noir movie we've covered after Raw Deal, where the climax takes place in the fog. And I wanted to know what you thought of that eerie final sequence where Bard and Annie are in one of those mountain swamps that we have all, you know, mountain swamp. It's a common environment. What did you think of it, and how did you think it made as a capper for the movie?
It could have gone so wrong. But I thought it was really effective. I mean, there was a moment where I wondered, were they imagining these voices coming up on them? Are they kind of losing their minds? It just seemed like a really effective way to shoot the ending on a very low budget. So I liked it. What did you think?
I did too. I thought it was beautiful. Your imagination filled in so much. You didn't have to see all the cops around them. You didn't have to even see the swamp. And it was yet another moment on their downward spiral. This movie makes their downward spiral hurt, because they get to a point where they might be able to stop. And it's not that you want them to get away with what they've done. You just want them to stop. And, you know, there's that scene where they're dancing in the nightclub, and then all of a sudden they realize that the money they've been spending has been traced back to them, and they have to go on the run. And then here, you know, they've been running through the mountains, and they get that moment of rest in the thicket of reeds, just the last little shred of goodness they have left in their lives is the chance to sleep side by side in a safe place. And then they don't even get that. It breaks your heart. It's like they don't just fall, they hit the rocks again and again and again and again on the way down, like Wile E. Coyote. I liked it. I thought it was unusual and beautiful. Like Shelley said, instead of being dark and full of shadows, you have this ending where they are surrounded by ethereal whiteness, almost as if they've already died and gone to, well, not heaven, but something like it.
Right, because you have them going into the dark when they have to leave their car and they have to keep climbing through the mountains, and she's getting weaker and he's encouraging her, and they keep going and they keep going, and they think they can stop and they hear the dogs. And between the light and just them looking more haggard as the scene goes along, and they're close, their faces are in close up most of the time. It's the close up of the two of them together, because they're not turning on each other at this point. They're holding on to each other for dear life. She, because she's physically tired, and he because he wouldn't leave her in any case. And yeah, they get to the point where they can rest, and then then it switches to day, but it's really foggy. And so yeah, I did think that's a nice budgetary thing, because you don't have to show a lot of cops, you don't have to know exactly where the cops are, and it turns out that it's these two friends of his that he saw last at the house when they dropped the baby off and left, and they've come up and said, you know, there's no way out. And at this point, they're so drained and desperate and tired, you don't know what they're going to do, but it's pretty clear there's not going to be an effective shootout. And all they have is pistols anyway, so even if they wanted to shoot it out, they perhaps would have limited effectiveness. And then she precipitates the action, because she's scared. She's terrified. She doesn't know what to do. She's never going to give up. And that's how they end, you know, in tragedy. And it reminded me again, like the three movies that come to mind for me are They Live by Night, Bonnie and Clyde, and then also High Sierra. In High Sierra, Bogey and Ida Lupino are not together at the end. He's in the mountains by himself, and he's trapped in a similar way. He's like, you know, you've been there for a really long time and you can't get out. But there's this sense that, like, he's trying to climb out of whatever risk he's been facing for this last period of the movie, but he finally runs out of places to run, which is exactly what's happened to them. And they die in sort of this crumpled, foggy heap.
Yeah, he gets lit up, which is, I mean, you don't see the blood splatter like you do in Bonnie and Clyde, but he gets thoroughly perforated with bullets at the end of this movie. It is not a nice ending for him. Annie gets the quick death. And I love the irony of when he finally kills, he does it to save other people from his girlfriend.
Right.
And then, you know, then other people hear the gunshot and kill him for trying to save their lives.
It happens so quickly, but it's so important. It really is. Because that always seemed to me that's what would cause him to kill, either to protect her or to protect others, when it's clear that she's not going to go down without taking somebody with her if she can avoid it.
The one problem I have with this movie, the only problem I have with this movie, which is otherwise a superb film, is the way that it walks right up to the idea that there's something poisonous about guns in American culture and the obsession with guns. And then it goes, nah, it's just an individual problem, not systemic, just individual. What do you guys think about that?
Well, okay, two things. The first thing I would say is that his obsession with guns early on would probably strike us more profoundly than it seems to have struck the people in that time, because, oh, he's obsessed with guns, but he won't kill anybody, so it's fine. And that seems like something they were feeling they could sell to movie audiences successfully. So obsession with guns, bad, but not alarming, you know? But the other thing is that from the world of 2023, I think all of it is more alarming and more fraught, and that it becomes, in that world, in the 50s world, more of a sort of a straight up crime story. And even though we're meant to sort of have feelings for them as characters, I think in the 50s moralistic universe, we're supposed to say, well, at the end, they got what they deserved, and they got killed, and the gun thing is no more relevant because that he had an obsession with guns earlier in the movie than it would be for any criminal who used a gun as the tool of his trade as a bank robber. Because at some point, once they've shown you that they and specifically he are obsessed with guns, they sort of move on from that, and the guns become the tools of the trade that they've adopted.
So I wanted to mention where a few of these performers ended up. You know, Peggy Cummins ended up being married for 50 years to her husband and didn't do a whole lot of acting, but lived to the age of 92 and died about 5 or 6 years ago. And the guy who played the sheriff, he and his wife ended up founding a restaurant chain in LA called Hamburger Hamlet. And the story is supposedly they chose the name because they want to appeal to actors, and every actor wants a hamburger and wants to play Hamlet.
So. My dad worked at a Hamburger Hamlet in New Jersey as a teenager.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. The guy who his name was Harry Lewis, and the guy who played the newspaper reporter, his name was Nedrick Young, and he ended up winning an Oscar for writing the movie The Defiant Ones. And of course, we had Russ Tamblyn played. He was 14 when he played young Bart, and he didn't dance though in this movie, I don't think.
No, the Seven Brothers are like 5 years away.
And John Dahl, you know, who talked about, was most famous, I think, for Rope. He died at the age of 50 in 1970, I think. And it sounded like he had gotten depressed. He was gay, and it seems like he wasn't that open about it during his career. And it sounds like he might have gotten into some addictions and that kind of thing, and passed away at a pretty young age. But I'm trying to think of the other noir. What's the other noir that he's known for? Besides, not Rope. There's another one that he.
I was going to say Rope's. Oh, I can't think of. That's Rope's the only one I can think of. I was going to say the big combo, but that's Joseph.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, is he in that too? Yes. I've seen that, but I can't remember.
That's one that's that was restored by the Film Noir Foundation.
Film Noir Foundation, yeah.
Yeah, so he's really good in that too. And I think when I was working on a story about LGBT characters in film noir for Noir City Magazine, I read that Hitchcock, when he cast Rope, he chose one actor who was gay, John Dahl, and then Farley Granger, who was bisexual, because he wanted that kind of sexual attention. He was such a complete pervert that he, I think he just really got off on that, on their secret lives
right,
of the actors, and how that would interplay with the plot about two gay friends who commit a murder.
Well, and similarly, there's a quote from Joseph Lewis that he wanted the Bart character to have an essential weakness relative to the woman, relative to Peggy Cummins' character, and that because he knew he was gay, the perception was that was an indicator of weakness. And Lewis was fairly open during his lifetime that was his. And I don't think it was, I think that was a mainstream enough opinion at that point that you can't call him a particularly bigoted homophobe, but he, you know, that was his perception. And I think I want to give the actor a little more credit than to say, well, he was gay, therefore he was a weaker character. I think if you look at that character on the page and if you follow the directions you've been given about how you're going to interact with this woman that you're desperately in love with and are, you know, willing to do the way she leads you to do them, I think you can give the actor some credit for that, because I do think there's a fundamental weakness in his character in that movie.
Oh, his performance is terrific. And I mean,
yeah,
I could not pretend to be in love with a man the way he is very effectively pretending to be in love with a woman here. It is a very convincing performance. And for someone, if that was not his natural inclination, that is a testament. And I mean this not ironically, not tongue in cheek. That's a testament to his skill as an actor. He's incredible in this movie. And you buy every sweat beaded look of lust that he gives her.
Yeah, well, gay guys are like, gay guys, you know, act from the time they're kids, just on their own lives. So there's a lot of preparation goes into these performances by people like him.
That's so incredibly sad when you stop to think about it.
Very much so. So I had a little thought exercise that I didn't actually do this on purpose, but it happened when I was watching the movie most recently and just thought about it. And I was recasting the leads in the movie. So don't feel like you have to do this, but I will go first and ask if you were casting the movie and you were to choose somebody else, if you had any thoughts about who you might choose. And I came up with Angela Lansbury and Henry Fonda for the leads, or alternatively, Ida Lupino. I couldn't come up with a second lead. Anyway, any thoughts on just sort of randomly who you might cast in these leading parts if you had the chance?
I was actually going to say that according to IMDb trivia, mountain swamps are a thing. Anyone who's done even a little mountain hiking knows that alpine marshes and swamps are quite common, especially in California. All it takes is a shallow depression that fills seasonally with snowmelt. Many, not all, alpine lakes have adjacent marshy areas. So I apologize to the mountains of California. I think the movie works as well as it does because you have these unknown actors. And I honestly can't think of any actors who wouldn't be too obvious in the role. Like I could see Lee Marvin doing this, but he has a hardness and a meanness that Bart Tarr lacks. I mean, maybe like a young Jimmy Stewart would be really interesting.
Yeah, I had the Roberts in my brain. I was like, could Robert Ryan do it? No, he's too, in the same way that Lee Marvin is just like, there's too much. It's just too much intensity there, which is why, because my read on Fonda was that, and I don't think he's a particularly exceptional actor. There's some parts that he did where he was quite good and some where he was not. But my read on Fonda is that he's just so powerfully earnest. And that's the thing about the John Dahl character. And again, I'm not recasting this because I think there's anything wrong with John Dahl and Peggy Cummins. It was just something that was in my head. And I just, like, the earnestness of Fonda, the look is wrong. I don't think he looks right at all for it, because the shape of Dahl's face is really good. He's lanky in a way. Fonda's quite tall, but this guy, especially at this age, he's lanky in a way that I think really works for the part. And just the physicality that he has with Peggy Cummins is good. So maybe I'm talking myself out of it. But just the sort of ridiculous earnestness that Fonda had. And the reason I picked either Angela Lansbury or Ida Lupino is that both of them have this ability to be one way and then switch on a dime, Lansbury especially. And I'm not even just talking about Manchurian Candidate, but there are so many roles in which she's not even trying to be the best, sweetest. She's not faking who she is. She's being real, but then something will happen and she'll switch. And Lupino does that really well too. And this is the period of her career, maybe a few years, maybe like 5 years earlier. This is the period in her career where she was doing parts like that, where she could be desperately in love with somebody, or she could also be, you know, an opportunist or manipulative in some way, and do so in a way that is like purely driven by emotion. So that was kind of my motivation for those choices.
Okay, so I'm going to go with Elijah Cook Jr. So I'm going to cast him. He starts off as this insecure, nebbishy guy who's a great sharpshooter, and his love for Claire Trevor brings out his heart and soul, and he becomes this more full, likable person, but at the same time committing robberies with Claire Trevor, who is, you know, a psychopath.
I'm with you on the Claire Trevor works for me, absolutely.
I know Elijah.
I'm going to get us to do Claire Trevor.
Elijah Cook Jr., but
that's crazy.
Interesting. When I think Claire Trevor, I think Raw Deal, but I also think Stagecoach. So I don't know.
I think we're going to do Key Largo pretty soon. Yeah. I've got Key Largo on my brain. I think for like this fall, we might do Key Largo.
Oh, so. You know who I would love to see in the Annie Larry star role? Veronica Lake.
Oh,
that was the one that she was allegedly considered for that. Thank you for reminding me. She was allegedly considered for this part, which I could totally see. Like her performances are uneven. Like sometimes I really like Veronica Lake and sometimes I don't. And I don't know what she was sort of like in this period. Like I can't even think of a movie that she made at this point. I guess she was still acting, but that would have been super interesting. Yay, we've recast the movie that doesn't need to be recast. Congratulations to us. Anything else we want to say about this movie before we close out?
Well, I'm going to wear pants to all my armed robberies, I tell you what.
I mourn for those steaks that were lost in the meat holdup. Those poor steaks. He didn't do anything wrong.
Those cows died for nothing.
Along with that poor chick.
Those were ribeyes.
Yeah, well, I know.
Ribeyes.
So, again, animals did not fare well in this movie, I'm sorry to say. Did not pass the... We need a name for the test of whether the animals live or die in the movie, but it failed it, sadly.
Where was the Humane Society when this was being made? My God.
Right? Well, thank you so much, Nathan Alderman and Randy Dutinga, for joining me to discuss Gun Crazy. We will be back next week with All That Heaven Allows from Douglas Sirk. In 1955, we'll be back next week with All That Heaven Allows from Douglas Sirk, a big 50s lush Technicolor film, very different from this one, but also a lot of fun. Remember that if you would like to keep up with the show, to subscribe, to read all the show notes, to find out what we've done in the past, please go to theincomparable.com/LTS. You can also follow us on Twitter, for some reason, at Lion Tower Shield. You can follow us on Mastodon at Lion Tower Shield at Zeppelin.flights. All of that information is in the show notes. We have an email address, too. If you want to send some feedback, that would be LTS@theincomparable.com. Our spring 2023 season continues next week. And until then, goodbye for now.